You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, some Wisconsinites may be returning to work, the gym, bars, restaurants, but we may also need to take some emotional precautions as we venture out. Two healthcare experts give us some advice on emotional protective equipment. Now, college campuses are thinking about whether or not to reopen this fall, and they're facing big challenges no matter which direction they choose. Many UW system schools have said their decisions could come 2 months from now in July. In an interview this weekend with CBS, UW-Madison Chancellor Rebecca Blank talked about the planning process they're taking on.
We're doing all the planning we can to think about how we manage that scenario, even if the coronavirus is ongoing. But there's just an enormous amount of uncertainty.
Scott Jasek is an editor at Inside Higher Ed. Scott, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
Well, it turns out a lot of the college experience involves being in an enclosed space with lots of other people from different places. This is a huge challenge for campuses, isn't it?
Yes, it's a huge challenge, and the colleges are doing varying things. Some colleges, like Cal State, has announced that they're all going to be all online next semester, pretty much all online. Other colleges are announcing that they're going to come back, and still other colleges are coming back early, but then will be done around Thanksgiving because they fear a second wave of coronavirus.
Right. So you've been writing about this, and your website or your magazine had laid out a bunch of different options. That was an interesting one, dividing up the fall semester into two chunks so they could kind of dip their toe in without committing to 4 whole months of learning.
Right. It might mean that you'd take one or two courses intensely first and then have a second period. And Colorado College and a few other colleges have done this for a long time. Beloit is starting to do it this year because of coronavirus.
Is there a trend when it comes to, you know, who is saying, yeah, we're coming back, no, we're going all virtual in terms of size or type of college?
You know, there are large and small colleges doing both. It depends on a number of things, including, the state you're in, how bad the corona situation has been there, the politics of the governor and the legislature, it's frankly a university president's sense of risk because, you know, imagine if you let everyone come back and then there was another outbreak.
And I've seen some, including here in Wisconsin, some colleges saying we're going to decide maybe in July, which sounds like that could add stress all its own. People waiting until, you know, a month before dorm move-in to know if they have a dorm to move into.
Yeah, that will definitely add stress. On the other hand, I think there's some smarts to it. I look in the announcements of colleges that are coming out this week, and they all have a lot of reference to, well, but situation may change. And so it's not really so definite now. But a delay in announcing what you're going to do is going to frustrate parents, going to frustrate students. There's no way around it.
We're talking to Scott Jasek with Inside Higher Ed about the decisions facing colleges and universities around the country about what to do in the fall, how to reopen, how much to reopen, go all virtual. Now, aside from some of the obvious things like how classes are going to work and whether people live in dorms, what are some of the other things that campuses are thinking of when it comes to social life and athletics and all the other stuff that might come along with going to school?
Well, I mean, social life is going to have to be restricted. I mean, until there's a vaccine, there's definitely going to be danger from lots of people massing together. Now, whether students will go along with that really remains to be seen. On sports, the Texas universities are saying that they're going to have football with fans, but many others doubt that's going to be the case. So, this is a huge issue. And in the dorms where students live, some colleges are announcing they're going to all single rooms. But I'm not sure if a place like Madison could do that.
You wrote a piece looking at a survey that was done based on some of the options you all at Inside Higher Ed had laid out, a survey of students. What kind of options did they seem to like best and dislike the most?
The students want a traditional college experience. They would love for it to just be the same as it was. And who can blame them? But it may not be possible. And it goes all the way from there to, all online is very unpopular with students.
One issue that I hadn't thought of, but I saw UW-Platteville, a campus in a smaller town in a rural community, their concern was not necessarily for the students themselves, but for the local community. If students helped transmit the disease into the off-campus community and overwhelm the healthcare system, have you seen other campus administrators thinking along those lines?
Well, yes, but there are other thoughts, too. I mean, if you're in a small college town, the students coming to the town could transmit coronavirus. That's definitely true. On the other hand, if you're a small college town and you don't have students, the town may not be able to function economically. So this is really a classic, where you are damned if you do, damned if you don't, situation.
Speaking of the money side of things, what are universities and colleges looking at in terms of financial impact of having to shut down partially or completely?
They're looking at huge losses. In addition to the cost of sending their students home for 2 months, you've got states in terrible situations, cutting budgets by a lot. And the universities are cut in a very difficult situation where many of them are laying off adjunct professors. Some of them are laying off full professors and eliminating departments. They don't have the money. So it's getting very ugly.
One notion I've seen floating around out there is, if you're a student or a parent and you're paying community college, technical college prices, switching to virtual learning for a while doesn't sound so bad. If you are paying big university costs, especially maybe out-of-state costs, and you think, I'm just getting the virtual experience from this, is this going to make people rethink their priorities of where they go to school or send their kids to school?
Many of the surveys have suggested that students will be more likely to go to college close to home. So those who are coming to Wisconsin from far away may be reluctant, particularly if a lot of the education is online. Community colleges, are serving a local community, so they have a good basis there. But many community college students are so poor that they don't have a computer, that they, that their device is their phone. And so there's a different set of issues for community college students.
Scott, what other issues are you watching out here? So much going on facing colleges, universities, their faculty, staff, and of course students. What do you have your eye on?
The big decision is to go back in the fall or not, or to fully go back in the fall or not. Most colleges say they will certainly be teaching, but whether that is online or in person is a huge question. And then related to that, how many students show up?
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Bye.
That's Scott Jasek from Inside Higher Ed. He is with us today to talk about how college campuses are deciding whether to reopen or not this fall and some of the safety challenges behind those decisions. By the way, coming up on Monday, we'll hear from a guest who makes the case for public schools to reopen sooner than currently planned under the coronavirus pandemic. We'll hear that argument and the case that schools can be reopened safely. Coming up, how about some late spring horror film shop talk? We'll hear from Wisconsin filmmakers aiming to help others in their field with their podcast. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, an indie horror film podcast is Rising from the Dead to help other filmmakers learn from the creator's experience in the industry. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a healthcare worker.
As a public health nurse, Eva Radomski is used to stepping in when a crisis arises. Like many healthcare workers around the world, she's had to switch gears to help people during the pandemic. For Radomski, that means working as a contact tracer, a person who helps figure out how COVID-19 is spreading in Wisconsin. WPR's Jenny Peek talked with Radomski about what it's been like to leave her usual job, which focused on tuberculosis, to help fight COVID-19.
Eva Radomski is a public health nurse for Public Health Madison and Dane County. Since early March, she's been calling people who have tested positive for COVID-19, finding out who they've been in contact with, and informing those people they've been exposed to the virus. It's a tool to connect the dots of how COVID-19 is spreading, hopefully slowing it down along the way.
Contact tracing is a tool that helps slow the spread in a very easy way. It's a way for us to make a phone call to let them know they've been exposed, that they need to isolate, and that stops one more person from spreading the communicable disease, in this case, COVID-19. You interview the person who tested positive for COVID-19. We start by identifying when their symptoms started, and then we go back an additional 2 days. Then from that date, we ask them who they've been around and where they've been. They give us, you know, as much information as they can about the people and the contact information to get a hold of them, and then that's when the contact tracing begins.
Radomski says a lot of people she talks to already know they've been exposed. It's a welcome relief so that she doesn't have to be the bearer of bad news.
There are a few people who we do tell them that they've been exposed, and they are, like any human, frightened or angry, sad, worried. And that's okay, because then we are the resource for them. We go over the recommendations that the CDC has about what they have to do for isolation and what criteria needs to be met for them to discontinue their isolation. We also go over what to do for household members, you know, separating themselves, social distancing in the household.
Even so, she says there's still confusion. People often wonder how long they have to isolate and how to navigate what can feel like constantly changing recommendations.
I think the hardest part is people understanding when they're okay to discontinue isolation. So we really just reference them to the Public Health Madison and Dane County website, and for them to check that frequently, because we do update that on a regular basis, along with, you know, being able to contact any of us public health nurses at any time, and we're happy to help.
Along with an increase in contact tracing, the state is also increasing access to testing, including a site in Dane County.
If you do think you've had an exposure and or are having symptoms, Dane County is now having mass testing available at the Alliant Energy Center, where anyone can go get tested no matter your symptoms. And there's drive up, walk up, bike up. And if you don't have transportation, you can reach out to public health, and we are more than happy to help arrange transportation for you.
While the stress of the moment may make tensions high, Radomski wants people to know that contact tracers, like herself, are there to help clear up some of the uncertainties surrounding COVID-19.
I think it's just important to know that when we're calling you, you know, we're calling with a helpful heart. We're calling you just to let you know and to provide helpful information and education. And we understand frustration and understand any human feelings. And we are more than willing to take suggestions or dive deep to find extra education or information that you need. Please reach out to us with any, you know, questions or concerns that you might have, because we are more than willing to, you know, go that extra mile to make people feel safe at home and in the community.
WPR's Jenny Peek brought us that story on Eva Radomski, a COVID-19 contact tracer in Dane County. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, Chris Miklas and Jay Sapiro don't just like to scare people, they do it for a living. The Madison-based filmmakers are part of the production company Three Tortured Minds, which makes indie horror films. Their first debuted in 2018. It's called The Nursery. Here's a little of the trailer.
Oh, my God.
The rising chill of panic.
I'm sitting here with a bunch of paranoid hysterics talking about ghosts. There's no such thing as ghosts.
The pungent stench of dread.
And she was just staring at us.
You just said you couldn't see her face.
I know, but I could feel it.
Chris and Jay also started a podcast, Indie Horror Rising, to go behind the scenes of making and distributing their movie. They've recently brought the podcast back to life as a weekly series. We have them both on the line now. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
And Jay, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Chris, what made you want to share kind of the nuts and bolts behind the scene talk about the work that goes on in making an indie horror film in podcast form?
Well, it's both wanting to share some of the nuts and bolts, because when we made The Nursery, which we started back in 2016, we really didn't know, you know, what we were doing, to be honest with you. And especially when it came to the business side, you know, the financial side, the legal side, and especially the distribution side, it was the kind of thing that there were not really very many good resources that you could track down to find good practical information. And so we thought it might be interesting to do a podcast, at first talking about The Nursery and the step-by-step process we went through, but now it's evolved into being a resource for other filmmakers to promote their work, to talk about filmmaking, and we hope it's something that other filmmakers, genre fans, and even students will get a lot out of.
I wanted to ask Jay, I imagine a lot of the people who would listen to this would be people who want to make films themselves, but it sounds like it would be fun if you're into these movies to kind of lift the veil. Do you get a lot of audience, you think, from just fans who want to see how the magic is made?
I do. I think that it's not just filmmakers. I think that's a good point, that fans of horror or just fans of film could get a deeper understanding of, you know, like our last podcast focused on distribution. You know, how does a movie get made, and how do you find a distributor, and how does that work? We talk with directors and kind of their thoughts and what their thinking is behind a shot, a scene, writers, how things all come together. So I think people that are just interested in films and media creation could take a lot from this and have a lot of fun with a lot of folks we have on and some of the tips and pointers that we share throughout the podcast.
And Chris, something I want to ask about, since we're Wisconsin Public Radio, what's it like being a horror indie filmmaker in Wisconsin?
Well, we had a great experience. Our first movie, The Nursery, had an entirely Wisconsin-based cast and crew. Everyone involved in the production was Wisconsin-based. Our upcoming film, The Headmistress, all the crew was still Wisconsin-based, though we had some actors from out of state come in and join us for the production. But there's actually a pretty decent horror community here in Wisconsin. Some of the notable productions the last few years have been hopefully ours, but also Gags the Clown up in Green Bay that got a lot of notice. There's a cool documentary series and now Amazon Prime series called Haunted State that's being produced up in the Fox Valley. And there's a lot of good horror fans and filmmakers here in the state. So it's actually pretty cool. We've got a pretty thriving community.
Jay, with The Headmistress now, your next film after The Nursery, did you take a lot of lessons learned from The Nursery and then from analyzing it in your podcast that made it flow better for you in the production of The Headmistress?
Indeed, we did. Like as Chris mentioned, The Nursery was our first feature film, our first film in general, and we did learn a lot. As a matter of fact, we took notes as we went through the whole production process. In addition, you know, Chris and I both directed the film, The Nursery, and we both direct The Headmistress. And then I was the editor on The Nursery and I am on The Headmistress. And I take all kinds of notes just so I can share some tips and thoughts for myself, for us as we keep making films. But that really makes its way into the podcast where we can, again, as Chris mentioned before, just share these kind of thoughts and tips for those filmmakers that are out there that, you know, hopefully they can learn from either our mistakes or they can learn from what we've done the right way.
Now, a lot of people, I think, have the dream of making movies, but I want to ask each of you, we'll start with you, Chris, why horror in particular? What led you there?
Well, I've been a lifelong horror fan. I grew up on the old classic movies from the, you know, 30s and 40s and 50s, the Universal classics, and then, you know, on into the Hammer films and the big monster films. You know, I was truly a monster kid when I was growing up. So when Jay and Glenn, our third partner, decided that we were going to do this, we were going to make a film, I lobbied pretty hard for horror, and partially because it was my first love. but also it's, you know, for lack of a better word, it's among the more forgiving genres. You know, you can have a less experienced cast, you know, production values, though we are incredibly proud of the production values of The Nursery, they're a little more forgiving and you can still find an audience where some of the other genres you just can't. And so that was, I think, the best card in my deck when I was pitching it to Jay and Glenn.
And Jay, what led you down the horror path, except apart from Chris?
Well, Chris was definitely a big part of that. But like Chris said, it is forgiving, but also we self-financed the first film, and it also is horror can be a little bit cheaper to produce, and has a better return on investment generally. When you put out a feature film and the kind of funds that you can make back once your film is distributed, you have a better chance of making back your funds and potentially making some extra cash. So that was also something that really turned us on, again, with Glenn, our third filmmaker. So it did seem like horror was the right way to go. And we all really did coalesce around horror. We had some really good ideas, I think more so than with comedy or other, you know, dramas and things like that. We just really did click when we started talking about horror as our first feature film.
Chris, in our last minute or so, we can't go to movie theaters right now. Can you make the case to do some online searching or look through our streaming services or maybe screaming services for some indie horror films in particular?
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of opportunity out there, and you know, one, we'd love it if people check out The Nursery. They can currently find it on iTunes. You can find it on Amazon Prime. You can find it on Tubi, and a number of other services. You know, we got a real wide release, but there's a lot of platforms out there, whether it's the ones I just mentioned or a place like Shudder, or of course Netflix has a really nice collection of horror films. We are distributors, Uncorked Entertainment, and they've got a nice slate of films coming up. We just, on Friday's episode of the podcast Indie Horror Rising, we're talking with Miles Doliak, whose new film The Dinner Party is coming up, and Jay and I got to see a screener that's being released in a couple weeks, and it's a terrific film. So there's really a lot of great movies out there that we really would, people have a lot of opportunity to scream at home.
Chris and Jay, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Madison-based filmmakers Chris Miklos and Jay Sapiro of Three Tortured Minds Production Company. Their new podcast, or newly revived podcast, is Indie Horror Rising. Their movies include The Nursery and The Headmistress. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, Kate Archer Kent checks in with Wisconsin Senators Ron Johnson and Tammy Baldwin over the course of the morning. Find out what they have to say about the latest efforts on COVID-19 relief and more. That's tomorrow morning here on the Ideas Network. Now, whether directly or indirectly, the coronavirus pandemic has had traumatic effects for a lot of people. Could mean the loss of a friend or loved one, or the loss of a job, or feeling sadness for others who have been hit harder. And as we reopen more and more of the economy, it can be hard to keep our spirits up amid the uncertainty. Michigan State University health and wellness educators Jennifer Johnson and Claudia Finkelstein, together with their colleague Julia Felton, wrote a piece recently for The Conversation about preparing ourselves individually for what lies ahead in reentering public and workspaces. Jennifer Johnson is the C.S. Mott Professor of Public Health and Professor of OBGYN and Psychiatry at Michigan State. Dr. Johnson, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Claudia Finkelstein is Director of Wellness, Resilience, and Vulnerable Populations at Michigan State. Dr. Finkelstein, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Dr. Finkelstein, this is something I know you think about even when we're not in the midst of a pandemic, how we emotionally recover from and handle traumatic health-related events. Are there lessons from your kind of day-to-day work in the past that you think apply particularly well right about now?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, human beings, we are the same no matter what circumstances we're in. And despite the variability of everyone's circumstances, we can do things in common looking at what are our intrinsic signature strengths that have gotten us through rough times in the past. Anyone who's made it through to adulthood has survived some form of trauma or another, and drawing upon your signature strengths upon the people around you, and just keeping your body well-tuned are very important basics. Beyond that, learning to regulate your own emotions and, you know, as we mentioned in the article, getting a little space in between the thoughts and emotions that arise in a stressful situation and any action that you take in response. So they're very basic skills, but very difficult to come up with in an emergency at times.
And Dr. Johnson, are there things in particular about a public problem like this? A lot of times our health issues are private. Our tragedies and traumas are limited to those close to us. Is there something different when it's this big? It is the top news story on the planet.
Well, you know, I think it both makes it easier and harder, right? It's harder in the sense that it's hard to get away from it. It's hard to get a break. And one thing we've been recommending to people is to take news breaks, to find some time to just think about something else. And that's really important. The one upside is that it isn't as isolated and that it might be easier to find people to talk to about what's going on, because you can probably find one, if not many, people who are going through something similar to you.
And Dr. Finkelstein, one problem from early on here was with social distancing, with staying at home, with businesses being closed and events. A lot of the places we might turn to for comfort and community were shut off to us. How can we overcome that obstacle?
Absolutely. I think it's interesting because the previous Surgeon General of the United States, Dr. Vivek Murthy, even way before the pandemic, was talking about the epidemic of loneliness in the United States. So there was a certain degree of isolation that I believe predated the pandemic and has just been exacerbated by it. I think that we're lucky to live in an age where technology means that we don't have to be completely isolated, but there's no question that the virtual world is not exactly the same as the real one. As Jennifer was saying, the good news is that everybody has had life disrupted in one way or another, and I think that breaks down a barrier to talking to your colleagues, your family members, your neighbors, virtually, of course, distancing, perhaps on a deeper level than you would otherwise. I think employee assistance programs still exist, and there's been a rapid move towards telehealth, including teletherapy. And I think that we should all encourage each other to avail ourselves of any resource we have available.
We're talking to Claudia Finkelstein and Jennifer Johnson from Michigan State University about how to deal with our emotions during the coronavirus pandemic and as we start to go back out in public more in the weeks and months to come. Dr. Johnson, one concrete piece of advice that I thought was interesting in the piece you co-wrote was the way we talk about and to ourselves. If we're thinking things like, I can't deal with this, that may not be so good, but if I talk to myself like, Rob, here's what you do, for some reason that third-person conversation with myself can help?
Yes. So what it does, you know, a thought like, I can't deal with this, is very personal, very immediate, and if you even just say it out loud, you'll notice yourself, you know, feeling a little more anxious. But when you can put a little bit of distance between yourself and that overwhelming feeling, it gives you, like I said, that little bit of distance to kind of get through the moment.
Dr. Finkelstein, how do we catch ourselves in those moments where, you know, our negative thoughts, and negative thoughts are perfectly fine and valid, but how do we catch ourselves when we're going, letting them take over too much?
I think the body gives us a lot of good clues, you know. So if you start noticing that your fists are balled up, that your heart is racing, that you're breathing fast, you know, that's when we're really riled up or anxious. And noticing this change in what your body feels like may be the invitation to just unclench, take a few very deep breaths, and just, you know, simple emotional regulation techniques. But as you mentioned, the first thing you have to do is notice that you're off kilter. So in the moment, the body has clues. In day-to-day life, there are clues. Like if you are eating much more than usual, drinking much more than usual, there are clues in your own behavior as well as in your body.
And Dr. Johnson, we heard from some of our listeners on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Rebecca writes, "I'm excited to see my work family. If they are the only ones I interacted with, I'd be thrilled. Unfortunately," Rebecca says, "I work with the public, and the amount of anxiety that is giving me can't be healthy." She goes on, "I have not gotten the word that we're reporting back yet, but when we do, I don't know if I'm emotionally ready." Dr. Johnson, what do you think? Is there an emotional toolkit we can have in that moment of returning to work and the anxiety that might come along with it?
Sure. So, I mean, there are some tips in general, right? And it's some of the things we've been talking about that just help your body deal with stress and your mind deal with stress better. And that's, you know, exercising, trying to keep a schedule, taking a minute to just breathe, eating well, practicing grace and flexibility with yourself, doing things you enjoy. You know, I wasn't quite sure in the writer's comment if she's anxious about physically interacting with so many people because of COVID, or if just the thought of going back is making her anxious. You know, there are people for whom they were stressed out a little bit by their jobs, and not having to deal with some of the people they have to deal with was kind of a relief. And there are people who are naturally introverted who have kind of liked being home. And for those people, just the sort of shift of having to go out and interact with a lot of people again, or maybe interact with people who are angry with you, you know, it takes a little bit of preparation. But, you know, if you did it before, you can do it again. And, you know, taking care of yourself is a good way to get ready to do that.
We're talking to Michigan State University health and wellness educators Jennifer Johnson and Claudia Finkelstein about how to develop, in effect, emotional protective equipment for ourselves as we move forward through the pandemic. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What are some of your biggest worries about reentering public spaces, about going back to work or continuing work, maybe with more people around if you've been working all along? Do you have things you've done to keep yourself grounded, feeling emotionally healthy when things are looking bad? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you could join in the conversation over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Drs. Jennifer Johnson and Claudia Finkelstein from Michigan State University. We're talking about developing emotional and mental health personal protections as we re-enter public spaces amid the coronavirus or continue to work in them if you've been out there already. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you felt anxious about the health or the economic sides of what's going on with COVID-19? Have you found ways to work through that anxiety along the way? What do you tell your kids? If you run a workplace, how are you working with your employees? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Chris on Facebook, who works in retail, says they're having a hard time as it is trying to weather the wave. And what worries them is how people are not following distancing, not wearing masks, and acting as if there's nothing wrong. Chris writes, "My anxiety levels have taken a beating during this, and I've weathered worse, but nothing like this." Well, that makes me think you also wrote, Dr. Finkelstein, in the piece we're talking about what employers and managers can do to work with their employees in that tough situation.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really important point. And I think that the people that have continued to work in retail, you know, in the grocery stores and everything, are really some of the very unsung heroes. I think that workplaces can make very explicitly clear, both to their employees and to their clients, what the policies are in order to keep everyone safe and to enforce them. so that actually there's a zero tolerance for people who are not following the safety guidelines. Dr. Atul Gawande, he's a well-known Harvard surgeon and writer, has determined there are four essential pillars to keeping communal spaces safe, and they involve hygiene, distancing, screening, and mask use. So I think the employers posting signs about, you know, in order to enter this space, you must meet these criteria, and then really, truly enforcing it so that the frontline guys do not have to spend their entire day full of anxiety of people disobeying the guidelines.
We also heard from Laura on Facebook. Laura writes that she's a nurse and is doubling down on distancing and preparing for the tsunami. Dr. Johnson, do you have thoughts for healthcare workers who have really seen this on a lot of ads? They have to keep working in most cases. They're at risk of maybe bringing the disease home. And, of course, they've seen the impact of COVID-19. Thoughts for people who work in the healthcare line?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, it is really, really stressful. We keep saying that, but it really is. And so, you know, for a lot of our frontline folks, you know, a lot of people go into those fields. They want to help. They want to fix things. But it's really important to recognize that responding to this can take an emotional toll on anyone. And, you know, signs of secondary traumatic stress can be physical, like fatigue or illness, or mental, like fear, withdrawal, or guilt. And that's just really important, if you can at all, to get a little bit of time for you and your family to recover from responding, even if it's only 30 minutes, even if it's only a few hours. Take a break from the media coverage. Make time for personal self-care activities that you enjoy, you know, like exercising or reading a book. And recognize that even supporters need support. And if your stress level is getting to the point that it's affecting your ability to do what you need to do, you know, talk to someone. And that's part of staying healthy.
Dr. Finkelstein, I wanted to ask about the role of uncertainty in all of this. So we don't know how COVID-19 is going to shake out in the months to come, and we don't know how the economy is going to do in the months to come, and that's hurting people in different ways. Do you have thoughts on how we can cope with that kind of really unresolvable uncertainty?
Oh, it's really hard. First, I want to just mention one thing. The Parachute Project is an online group of therapists and psychiatrists who are willing to provide emotional support to any frontline workers. So for the nurse who made the comment earlier, you may want to Google the Parachute Project as a possible source of support. In terms of uncertainty, I think that's one of the toughest things for we humans to deal with. And I think continually trying to remind ourselves that we have very limited control over the external circumstances. The only thing we can control is our own response during the circumstance. So I think really, you know, as we wrote in the article, the self-compassion, talking to yourself as if you're talking to a friend. Yes, this is hard. You know, pretending that it's not hard won't do you any favors, but we know we can get through this. You know, I think there's no denying the uncertainty takes a toll. And getting away from it, as Jennifer was mentioning earlier, changing your own channel by doing something entertaining, joyful, relaxing, to take your mind off continuously grinding over things that we don't have answers to yet.
Thanks. We'll leave it there. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having us.
That's Jennifer Johnson, professor of public health and professor of OBGYN and psychiatry at Michigan State University, and Claudia Finkelstein, director of wellness, resilience, and vulnerable populations, also at Michigan State. We talked to them today about how we can prepare and protect ourselves mentally and emotionally as the pandemic goes on and as we start to come out of it over the months to come. Over 30,000 Wisconsinites with disabilities require some level of care or support. Most of that is done in person, even during the pandemic. And as Bram Sable-Smith reports, that makes people with disabilities particularly dependent on the actions of the broader community.
When the Wisconsin Supreme Court struck down the state's Safer at Home order last week, Matt Ford said it was hard not to take it personally.
No one's recognizing the effort that we made as vulnerable people who need caregivers in and out of their homes.
Ford lives in Verona and is quadriplegic following a diving accident back in 1987. His father is his primary caregiver, but Ford still hires workers to help with tasks like running errands, making meals, and using the bathroom. One of those caregivers is Grace Burnett, who's worked with Ford on and off since 2016, when she saw his posting on the UW student job board.
It was like free-range quad looking for grocery help or something. I was like, okay, this guy seems funny.
Caregivers are already in short supply in Wisconsin. A recent report found a shortage of over 20,000. And when the pandemic hit, Ford was down to just two. It could have been less if Burnett had gone home to Rice Lake. Instead, she moved into Ford's basement to limit her contact with outsiders.
You know, he only has one other caregiver. I mean, that would be really selfish of me to just say sayonara, I'm going to go quarantine with my family when he needs the help.
Ford knows that sacrifice was made on his behalf, and he worries it could be for naught if the state opens too quickly and the virus spreads through the community.
I mean, I don't want people to go out of business either. You know, I do care about them. I have some empathy towards that. But I also don't want to die.
And Ford was fortunate to have his caregivers stay on. That was not the case for Stacy Ellingen. Cerebral palsy limits her mobility and fine motor skills, and she depends on care workers to live independently in an apartment in Oshkosh. But two of her three workers were nursing students, and when their classes were canceled, they left town, forcing Ellingen to move home with her parents in Fond du Lac. She uses an app on her phone to speak out loud.
I'm fortunate my parents are still able to do my cares, but it's a less than ideal situation for both myself and my parents.
Still, Ellingen feels lucky. The pandemic is threatening to deplete the caregiving workforce even more. If her parents weren't able to help, she says she'd likely need to live in a nursing home.
That's the last place anyone wants to be, especially during a pandemic.
The nationwide shortage of protective gear is also rippling through the disability community. Caregivers are having a hard time competing with hospitals and other providers over masks and gloves. That led Jason Endress to ask his caregivers not to come to his house in Eau Claire. Complications from spina bifida mean Endress has weakened lungs, and knowing that his caregivers work at multiple people's houses, he's not willing to risk having them come to his without proper masks.
There's so much COVID going around that if I can control my own environment, that's what I'm going to do.
So far, Endress says he and his wife, who has cerebral palsy, are managing. But tasks like shopping and cleaning take longer and happen less often. Advocates are calling on caregivers to be prioritized to receive protective gear. If life is going to resume, that's one way to help protect the disability community. But Matt Ford says even then, he can't help but be a little apprehensive.
Before, when everybody was pretty hunkered down, you felt like the people that were coming in were okay. Now there's a little more doubt.
And with the state set to reopen, that's the risk people who depend on in-home care are being asked to shoulder. Bram Sable-Smith, Wisconsin Public Radio.
That story comes from a partnership between Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Watch. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll check out the latest online survey of Wisconsin Conservation Congress members on issues like the deer hunt, lead ammunition, and many other issues facing the conservation and hunting community. This month marks the 60th anniversary of the birth control pill. We'll look back at some of the impact that it's had over the years and decades on American culture. And we'll find out why Governor Evers looks very different in polls than former Governor Scott Walker did. Craig Gilbert joins us from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel to look at polling since Governor Evers came into office and what it says about partisan divisions here in Wisconsin, especially during this big election year. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, Kate and her guests look at the impact of the coronavirus for people who are already living in poverty. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, where did the novel coronavirus come from? A reporter shares the rise and fall of the idea that it came from a Chinese lab, and what scientists think the most likely scenario actually is. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.